Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
And this is going to be really hard to do in podcast form because podcasting is not, RIP Jane Costin, a highly visual medium.
Welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with ProPublica's Dara Lind and Herman Lopez from Vox.com. Really glad to have you here, Herman. We wanted to talk this week about Biden's sort of early rollout of immigration ideas, which has included both a sort of official legislative proposal, which is interesting in its own terms, and also a kind of big batch of, you know, early sort of administrative actions, executive orders, things like that. I know, Dara, you, I think, are annoyed by my desire to talk about this proposed legislation.
No. Well, so when you first proposed this, like when the bill got rolled out on Wednesday, or when they announced the bill on Wednesday, the actual text of the bill has not been introduced yet, which is funny because they're already putting out social media graphics saying we introduced a day one bill. But, you know, at that time, I was feeling a certain amount of disconnect from what I was hearing publicly, because I was hearing a lot of stuff publicly that was, oh my gosh, this is a huge legislative priority for President Biden, as demonstrated by the fact that this is his day one bill. And I'm like, I hadn't gotten any sense of that prior to like the week before the inauguration. And in the intervening 6 days, I think the kind of public discourse has come around to what I suspected was happening in private the whole time, which is that a bill was introduced. There's a lot of enthusiasm around the details of the bill as a like, yes, if this could, you know, in like immigration advocacy world, like, yes, if this could become law, this would be huge. But there is not a serious drive to get immigration reform done under reconciliation. There is no obvious or articulated path to getting 10 Republican senators on board. And you're already beginning to see a little bit of, oh, well, like getting that bill to the president's desk isn't the goal. So it's an interesting illustration of the functions that a day one bill can serve that are not necessarily, this is my top legislative priority, because top legislative priority, as we discussed last week, is the COVID relief package. And there are questions as to what comes after that, but it's been an interesting illustration of where the Biden team thinks the immigration discussion is and who they think they need to have on board and who they need to placate.
But I think, you know, I would go further in some ways, right? Activists are so enthusiastic about the content of this proposal, in part precisely because it isn't a top Biden legislative, right? Because if it's a top legislative priority, then it either needs to be something that fits a reconciliation framework, or you need some plausible story about how a dozen Republicans are voting for it. But what Biden actually did was like, forget that, because reconciliation and immigration don't go together that nicely, particularly in terms of like creating a path to citizenship for people. And you get Republicans on board for something by compromising your views. So like this, I mean, we should talk about what's in it. But it's like immigration advocates would love for Joe Biden to sign this bill precisely because it's not like a good faith effort to get Jerry Moran to vote for it. It's a proposal designed to like say what progressives think about immigration policy.
Right. Like fundamentally, the proposition made by this bill is, what if we put together a bill that offered legalization with, you know, a eventual possibility of citizenship to unauthorized immigrants currently in the U.S., like broadly, on a slightly faster timeline than previous legalization proposals have, and we didn't pair it with more immigration enforcement. And that's, I mean, where it is distinguished from the way that comprehensive immigration reform has conventionally been thought of. It's distinguished from the 2006, 2007, 2013 immigration proposals. And so, like, the kind of meta message you can argue that the bill sends, you know, even if you think of it as like a message rather than a piece of proposed legislation, is, what if we as the Democratic Party didn't negotiate with ourselves first on immigration? What if, you know, what if the Democratic Party said, here is what we want. We do not think that enforcement needs to be paired with legalization. And if Republicans want to come to the table and say, here are the enforcement things we need, then we would rather have that conversation with them than try to figure out what they're going to want in advance. Which, no one is actually making that argument. I mean, maybe they're making it privately, right? But that's not the way that the bill is being publicly defended. The way the bill is being publicly defended is, it is bad to try to pair legalization with enforcement. That's not what we need. We've had increasing enforcement for the last 20 years without legalization. We just need legalization to catch up to it, which substantively, that's an awkward pairing. It's a little bit hard to imagine how you get, you know, 10 Republicans on board with a bill without losing some of the very voices who have been most enthusiastic about, yes, we finally have a bill that is legalization without enforcement. But the thing about proposing legislation that you don't think is going to immediately make it onto the president's desk is that there is a space between, oh, this is just a messaging bill, and this is an obvious no-brainer that everybody can vote for immediately. Like, there is some space for, okay, this is the opening shot in what we expect to be an ongoing volley, but you do have to have some sense of what the red lines are. And that, I think, is what is still a little bit, you know, is still a little bit murky on the administration's part. On the advocacy side, it's not that the question is the red lines. It's that the question is, to what extent the priority is to do immigration separately versus trying to get legalization into everything else. You're already seeing a certain amount of effort to talk about essential worker, like protecting essential workers as part of a COVID relief package. Whether, I mean, in its more moderate sense, that's just making sure that, unlike previous COVID relief packages, unauthorized immigrants like do get to share in the universal benefits of a COVID relief package. But you're also seeing a certain push to do some kind of legalization in a way that's going to work in a reconciliation package. And the story that Democrats are now pushing is, oh, maybe we can break this bill up into smaller legalization packages and try to get it done that way, which, you know, again, is probably, it's a strategy where you're more likely to get 60 votes out of some of this stuff. You're more likely to get 60 votes on, you know, DREAM, on TPS, or legalizing people who currently have temporary protected status, which they're legal. They don't have a way to get citizenship yet, but it also has it exists uneasily with this big Biden bill that they spent so much enthusiasm on in the first 24 hours of the administration.
I do think it's worth putting this in the context of like what Biden administration they were trying to do last week, because I was in a few of their executive action calls.
Oh, that's a few more than I was on.
They were pretty adamant about emphasizing like, look, we really want to move past the Trump administration. And like you saw that in their early executive actions on like ending the travel ban, reinforcing DACA, like the immigration ones were really related to this. Whether they're as like the reinforcing DACA one, like I was on that call and it's still unclear to me if it even does anything really. But I think that their point is like, look, we are taking a step away from this administration. That's their signature issue was immigration for a long time, at least the first 2 years. And they really, really want to emphasize that they are no longer acting like Trump. And or well, they were never acting like Trump, but they're not the Trump administration. They are not going to take this hardline stance on immigration. They're not going to try to pander to the xenophobia or any of that stuff that, that the Trump administration was doing.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I actually think it's continuing in the spirit of like things that they're not saying publicly, but that would make sense if this is the way they're thinking about it. Like, if you think about the executive actions as mostly undoing the things that Trump has done, undoing the damage, the case you can make for introducing that bill on day one is, and we also have a positive vision for how to move forward. It's not just about reinstating the 2017 status quo. But you're right that the substance of those executive actions was like a little murkier. The rolling back the travel ban, which unfortunately, like, now that there are all of these other bans in place due to COVID, saying the travel ban has become this totally analytically useless thing. And, you know, yesterday, the Biden administration actually expanded bans on people from country, you know, from particularly COVID hit countries from coming to the U.S. There are still bans in place from last year that the Trump administration said were supposed to help the economy recover, that make it impossible for like most family members to sponsor people to come to the U.S. So a lot of the people who were covered by the travel ban now still can't bring family members over because those other bans are still in place for now. They may be getting rescinded at some point. But the other executive actions were like even less well-defined. The DACA one, the best way that I can explain that is that because there is pending litigation in Texas, in which the conservative judge who struck down the expansion of DACA and the parallel program for parents of American citizens back in 2015, it is kind of on the cusp of ruling that DACA itself was illegal to begin with, which would then force the Biden administration to come up with some kind of alternative, like legal pathway to protect that same population of people. So the executive order was kind of a placeholder for if that happens, we will do something. But like, because that ruling hasn't happened yet, there didn't need to be any actual legal substance to it. And then there was, you know, also an executive order on interior enforcement that didn't in its text really do a whole lot, but that was subsequently prompted a memo from the acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security that did kind of declare the 100-day deportation moratorium that Joe Biden campaigned on in the Democratic primary. And so it would be reasonable to see those executive actions as sending the message that the Trump era is over and beginning to put the pieces in place to reverse some of that. I think that the question of what they're doing substantively is a little more complicated.
Well, here, wait, let's draw a distinction, right? Because so Trump, right, is very hawkish on immigration from the beginning of his administration through to the end. Trump is also quite lax on COVID, right? Like, we got to open up, you know, like it's all going to be cured with hydroxychloroquine and stuff like that. But because many countries have sort of sealed or restricted movement as part of their COVID response, Trump, while doing very little on COVID, did a lot of COVID-related immigration restrictions, right? So Biden runs against Trump, promising to be much more hawkish on COVID, right? But also to be more welcoming of immigrants. So when you look at these orders, you see a relaxing of a lot of Trump era things from pre-2020, many of which have been superseded by emergency by COVID orders, which have not been pulled back, right? And so there's a sort of defer, you know, so it's like they're going to stop building the wall, but like you actually can't get into the country from Mexico still. But so, you know, conceptually speaking, this is like Biden is sticking with Trump's COVID actions, but rolling back a lot of the pre-COVID immigration actions. And then there's the third bucket of things, which is just like the functioning of the normal immigration enforcement apparatus, which is like where the Obama administration spent several years fighting with various people about, did a big thing, got into court, right? And like I think the forward looking focus is going to be like, what does that deportation moratorium amount to? What happens on day 101? What happens when there's a confirmed secretary? You know, because like an acting secretary can send whatever memos he wants, right? But recalcitrant frontline immigration officers are not going to be responsive to a vaguely worded memo from an acting secretary. That's just like that. That's not how the world works. But I mean, it's not, I think, like incoherent to say, well, we're reversing the travel ban that was imposed in, what was it, 2019? But so Biden is saying that the like pretextual terrorism travel restrictions he's getting rid of. But even though Trump was using COVID in a pretextual way, Biden is still like favors those kinds of things. But then I think the question, right, for Biden on all of this is like, back to the legislation, right?
I think that framework is mostly correct, but a lot of what Trump did in 2020 on immigration restriction was not pretextually COVID. It was pretextually or intentionally letting immigrants in hurts the economy and we need to get the economy back on track. That was the justification for the immigrant visa ban and for the ban on many kinds of non-immigrant visas, work visas and that kind of thing. So like, it's actually a lot harder, especially because there's ongoing litigation about literally everything Trump did on immigration. It's harder for the Biden DOJ to show up in court in these lawsuits and say, yes, we agree that we need to continue these policies because immigrants hurt our economy, when Joe Biden is out here saying we need immigrants because immigrants help our economy. Like that's the tricky road. And that's where, you know, there is a sense that those bans are going to get rescinded.
Uh-huh.
There isn't.
But they haven't been.
It's not clear. Right. Like there's going to be, it's publicly known that there's going to be another batch of immigration executive orders coming Friday. It's not publicly known exactly what that's going to be. I'm hearing different things about whether that those kind of like economy justified bans are going to be rescinded or not. And so if they get rid of that part, then you're right, Matt. You know, they get the benefit of, you know, the COVID restriction is parts of the Trump regime and are able to roll back everything else.
But so I wanted to ask you about the legislation, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, so it's sort of a, you know, amnesty without an enforcement swap. Of course, we don't call it that. An earned path to legalization or whatever you're supposed to call it. But what does it say about like future immigration, right? There's something, because like I saw a bullet point that was like, we're going to clear the visa backlog, but I don't really know what that means.
I genuinely do not have an answer for you on this one, because I have not been looking into the details of this legislation. And I admit, like, future legal immigration is the place that holds in legislative politics right now is weird, because it used to be seen as, you know, in the kind of comprehensive immigration reform model, the political model is business really cares about future flows. Labor really cares about like certain things related to future flows. And so we're going to let those two stakeholders figure out what they can agree on. And, you know, now that like the idea that business and labor agree on something doesn't mean you get the Republican Party on board with it, that's all been scrambled. And you actually saw with in the last Congress, just how weird the politics of this have gotten, because there was a bill that actually made it surprisingly far that would have taken a minor action that had big consequences on the legal immigration front by getting rid of the provision in law that says no one country can get more than a certain percentage of the visas that are offered every year. And that in practice would be a great boon for like China, India, the countries that do send a great deal of you know, immigrant workers in particular to the U.S. By the time that actually got to the Senate floor, there had been like weird anti-China stuff put into it. The fight to get it on the floor was really behind the scenes kind of vicious. Like there were a lot of accusations flying around that, you know, Dick Durbin hated Indians because he wasn't willing to back this bill forcefully, that kind of thing. Just some very weird stuff. And it, I think, made it kind of obvious that the politics of future legal immigration are fraught in a way that isn't necessarily related to the way that the politics of legalizing unauthorized immigrants are fraught. So like when I see a bill like this, that, you know, like the one Biden proposed, that is like CIR without the enforcement, you know, I don't know how seriously I should be taking that as an indication for what a future legal immigration bill would look like, because there is a lot of energy behind breaking off the legalization parts of this and passing those. There is like a certain amount of energy and certainly some history in like the, oh, we're going to invest in Central America and we're going to develop a more regional approach, which is in that bill, but is also something that obviously Joe Biden was talking about as vice president, something that's been in other bills that were proposed during the Trump administration. I don't think we have a good sense of what the politics of that are going forward in a world where there isn't necessarily the energy from Congress to tackle big issues on a non-emergency timeline, and it's not being connected to something that a critical mass of people really want to push.
But so I think, right, this is my out-of-the-box idea, free to use by members of the U.S. Senate. Right. But that if you take some of the new immigration hawks, right, like a Tom Cotton or a what's his name, David Perdue, and you combine them with some of the lefty people who care a lot about enforcement and, you know, legalization, but don't really care about future flows or immigration policy at all, particularly if you think of somebody like Bernie Sanders, who has always seemed like he's actually against immigration, but also wants to side with immigrant advocates. Yeah, that instead of the traditional enforcement for legalization swap, you could have legalization for sharp reductions in future flows of legal immigrants, or, you know, a switch in the composition, right? That could be just like a straight anti-business compromise that combines what the restrictionists want. Because getting fewer immigrants by like trying to like drain the pool of existing undocumented immigrants, right, is really difficult. We've been not doing comprehensive reform and we've been ratcheting up enforcement, but like it doesn't work, right? It's like you're trying to drain the ocean with a thimble or whatever it is. Whereas like reducing legal immigration, I do not favor, but like I think would be efficacious in bending the demographic curve of the United States. I don't know, as just a spectator who enjoys legislating, I think somebody should try that swap, even though it's kind of a really bad idea.
I think the thing to be aware of there is that because we have been having a conversation about the immigration system is broadly broken and like needs to be fixed for a solid, at the most conservative accounting, 15 years. In those 15 years, you have had you've had kind of political stakeholders develop who weren't there, you know, a decade or 15 years ago. And like the growth of attention in certain progressive circles toward immigration enforcement and reducing it is certainly one component of that that Democrats are now responding to. But another component that you only saw crop up during the few abortive attempts the Trump administration made to actually pass immigration legislation is that Latinos in the U.S., people like Mexican Americans, people of other immigrant groups in the U.S., Latino immigrant groups in the U.S., and Asian Americans in the U.S. feel that they were, you know, historically shafted by the early 20th century immigration regime, that the current immigration regime is like what has allowed them to be in America, what has allowed them to, you know, keep their families together or allow family members to migrate, and that any change to the immigration system that hurts family-based immigration, which is almost certainly what would get targeted in a reducing legal immigration proposal, because it is like most of the permanent immigration that we have, would come under attack from those groups that would feel very concentrated harm.
Okay, let's take a break and come back to some of this.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I mean, Matt, you said earlier that that like people could just kind of ignore a memo from the acting secretary, which I giggled at because a lot of the last 6 months of Trump administration litigation has been whether Chad Wolf signed a bunch of things illegally because he was never legally appointed acting secretary to begin with. I think you're right that there are really big questions over the next 100 days about what happens in the enforcement components at CBP and especially at ICE. But we do actually have some indications because this is all being fought in court still and again, and because it's a Democratic administration, instead of being fought in California, it's now being fought in Texas because that's where you find the ideologically favorable judges who are likely to sign nationwide injunctions of policies that you disagree with. There is already a lawsuit in which Texas is using an agreement signed by the Trump DHS in its last days with the state of Texas saying that Texas gets to object to any immigration policy if they think it's not in their interests, which they are currently trying to invoke to stop the deportation moratorium. And that litigation is happening on a wildly expedited timeline so that we've already had a couple of like indications as to how the enforcement moratorium is or the deportation moratorium is going. And it does seem that I think it is fair to say at this point that we do know that there wasn't a plan to ground all deportation flights starting on Friday, the 22nd. There was at least one case in which it took a lot of kind of activist pressure on Sunday night to get, you know, a particular immigrant off the manifest for a deportation flight. And then that flight itself got canceled. But like, it's one of those things where that's the case that is publicly known. We don't have, you know, they haven't said we have stopped all deportation flights, and there's no, you know, we don't have evidence that that is the case. It raises questions about why advocacy pressure was needed if this moratorium is in fact in effect. And meanwhile, Texas is out there using a Tucker Carlson segment to argue that there was a secret order to release all immigrants from detention, which we now know, thanks to the Biden administration's reply, was an email sent at a single site to release people who were at high risk of COVID, which was already something that was being litigated. that there are real questions about how this is being implemented on the ground, not just in the are people dragging their feet sense, but in the sense of are people, trying to get out in front of this memo in the absence of more detailed guidance by kind of swinging back the other way aggressively and saying, well, if they don't want us to enforce things, then we'd better do exactly what they say, for, good faith reasons, bad faith reasons, whatever. This is the kind of thing that we're not going to have a very good picture of in real time. The release them all immediately email that the Tucker Carlson story was based on, seeing that email was really wild to me personally, because it's like the most real-time transparency we've gotten into ICE in the entire history of the agency. But it is something that is very important to figure out, and that I think maybe by the end of a 100-day period, we might have a better sense of what the enforcement situation has been. But I'm not seeing national attention to it. And it is kind of making me think that the kind of attention politics of the issue are that a post-Trump America doesn't really care about immigration enforcement that much.
I mean, to that end, one thing we have seen with the Biden administration in the aftermath of all these orders is just like a lack of follow-up, I think, in public, that is kind of striking to me, because they put all this stuff out on the first day. And I know that more is coming out this Friday, but it seemed like they were really ready to just like immediately move on this issue as quickly as possible. And while we've seen some reporting, like you said, it to me just really emphasizes that, like, I mean, it's kind of like they dumped this bill out there and these orders, and then they're like, all right, we know that this issue is contentious. It kind of created Donald Trump. Maybe we can say we tried our best here and move on. And like that's what I think about when I see the lack of transparency as to how all of this is working out. I think it's deliberate. I don't think they want to really lean on this issue for the next few months. I think they want to talk about the economy and how they're taking COVID seriously and climate change stuff. But immigration is an issue that I don't think the Biden administration really wants to focus on and make it their signature issue in the way that it was Trump's signature issue.
No, I definitely agree with that, right? I mean, I think like the message of this bill, it's like a funny twofold message, right? Because this incredible narrative took hold in the immigration community that Obama had betrayed them by not releasing a specific and detailed proposal early in his administration.
Because that was an explicit promise that they demanded of him and he made. And
I understand. But I mean, like, the premise of the anger over that broken promise is that had Obama done that, like, something good would have happened on policy, right? I mean, it's not real. So it was because, like, I just don't think that that was ever true or plausible. At any rate, so, like, Obama's with the one hand being like, see, this is what you asked for, a bill on day one, you've got it. And then we are going to get a live fire demonstration of exactly how little difference that makes, right? Because it's like Biden is a Congress guy, right? And so it's like, here you go, guys, an immigration reform proposal. And then, like, we shall see. Like, I think Biden would love if a future gang of 16 senators came together and, like, had some kind of bipartisan immigration bill. I think almost regardless of content, right? Like, Biden, like, loves bipartisan deals on things. But to Herman's point, right, Obama, by the end of his term, right, which is very different from the beginning, but by the end of his term, Obama was embracing immigration as a cause that he wanted to be identified with. You had White House staff talking about how, like, DAPA and stuff was, like, going to be part of his legacy and all these kinds of things. And, like, Biden does not want that, right? Like, these orders on immigration were not paired with, like, Joe Biden on camera doing interesting stuff, right? There was some, like, I am changing some of these policies. It's not meaningless by any means, but there's not a desire to, like, make a big deal about this, jump up and down and have an immigration focused national conversation. They probably wish we weren't doing this podcast at all. It's interesting because public opinion has become much friendlier to immigration than it was in 2013 and certainly than it was in 2007. There's been a real sea change in public opinion, but the congressional politics have gone 100% in the opposite direction, because it used to be that there was a significant pro-reform bloc of Republicans, which meant that there was a guarantee of bipartisan cover, which meant that a lot of Democrats who were responsive to sort of elite liberal views on immigration could feel comfortable with it, right? So like Joe Manchin was for the 2013 immigration bill, but immigration is not popular in West Virginia, right? But like bipartisan deals are popular everywhere. And so the polarization of the issue has suddenly made it much, much, much more difficult for the Democrats who represent rural states, right? So it's not just like the loss of a couple of Republican votes. Having lost the Republicans, you now lose a ton of Democrats and create a like almost insuperable bar unless something happens that makes Republicans want to engage with the legislative process. But for all the reasons that Herman was outlining, like I think Republicans will love to engage with the executive action process, right? Like this scenario you outlined with like Tucker Carlson got some email that he then mischaracterized and like everybody yelled about that for 48 hours. Like that's the kind of immigration politics that Republicans can get really excited about. There's millions of undocumented immigrants in the United States. On any given week, one of them is going to do something bad. And like you could talk about that. You could have many news cycles about how like this guy who through some order ICE was supposed to not do whatever was driving drunk and killed a nice white girl. And, you know, like it's a potential nightmare for Biden, who like I know doesn't want to deal with this, but like the absence of an affirmative immigration agenda doesn't make the topic go away. And if your opponents, like both like activists, you know, still want what they want to have to come up with something to ask for because that's their job. But like the opposition would really like to talk about different aspects of immigration enforcement going forward. Like they don't want to get up there and be like, we're the party that's stopping you from getting a minimum wage increase. Like that's what we're here in Washington to do. Like that's terrible for Republicans. Whereas saying that like they're on the side of the ICE agents trying to keep you safe, like that's what Trump taught them, right? Like I think when people talk about Trumpism without Trump, it gets pretty vague, but just like being really gung-ho about immigration enforcement because immigrants pose a physical threat to your security. Like Trump didn't invent that, but he like took it to a high level. And I think Republicans' takeaway is that that worked.
So there's a bunch here, and I do want to talk about that, but I want to talk a little bit first about the relationship between attentional politics and like substantive policy, because
it's a loose relationship.
Right, right. And like, and Matt, this is a point that like you were making as often as anybody during the Trump years, is that just because Donald Trump wasn't talking about deregulation all the time didn't mean that his executive branch wasn't engaging in a fairly aggressive deregulation campaign. Mm-hmm. Even though we now have a government that is less governed by the whims of a single person, it is still true that Joe Biden is not going to spend an equal amount of time talking about literally everything his administration is doing. So in theory, just because Biden isn't out there, you know, like doing photo ops on the immigration executive orders, that doesn't necessarily give us a sense of how aggressive implementation is happening on the inside. You know, what does raise questions is the fact that the Obama administration had to spend several years writing successive versions of memos on interior enforcement before they finally got a formulation and a process that could meaningfully constrain the local discretion of ICE field offices. So like whether you can really go immediately back to that after 4 years of Trump is an open question. And that's kind of where the, you know, what was going on with that Tucker Carlson email thing comes in. You know, it's the good thing about that is that it takes a while to get visibility there if the White House isn't making a big publicity push about it. And so it's going to take longer to get a critical mass of pressure from the left to do things more aggressively, especially because you can probably assume safely that there will be a little less appetite in the Democratic coalition more broadly for criticizing a Democratic president on immigration enforcement. That's not good for, I mean, it's really not good for journalists, but it's not good for transparency generally to not really know what's going on until you like can piece together a few, you know, like local Twitter threads. But it's a very common, you know, it's how we've gotten a sense of interior immigration enforcement for the last 10 years. So I don't anticipate it changing anytime soon. Instinctually, I agree with you that Trumpism without Trump logically would be big on immigration hawkery. But if you think about the things that the Trump administration was pushing in the lame duck period, like they passed a bunch of really aggressive immigration regulations and they weren't talking about those. Donald Trump was talking a lot about the 1619 Project and, you know, Section 230 and a lot of issues that were culture war issues, but weren't immigration related. And that's the kind of thing that you see a lot of enthusiasm about. Like, you're not seeing Josh Hawley out here. It's really, I mean, he did kind of substantively put a hold on the confirmation of Ali Mayorkas to be Secretary of DHS because he was concerned that Mayorkas' policies would be too dovish. But he's not like, that's not why he's talking, why he's going out on Fox News. That's not why he, you know, writes a New York Post op-ed. The news from this morning that Trump's former OMB director is going to start a like post-Trump think tank to keep his issues in the national conversation. You like look through the list of things they're talking about and it's like, transgender rights, critical race theory, tech monopolies stifling free speech. It's all of the 2020 iteration of Trump's culture war rather than the 2016 to 2018 iteration. And that makes me wonder if the way that Republicans are actually approaching Trumpism without Trump is not the way that, you know, I would have assumed that this looked substantively 3 years ago.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about what you said is that If you like put all this together, Biden not really focusing on specific policy aspects, I think it's notable that a lot of these specific policies poll well, like they are popular among Americans. But when you start shifting to the culture war stuff of immigration, that's when you start getting into dicier territory. Like that's when you start seeing the Republican base start getting riled up and conservatives getting riled up. I mean, it's what Tucker Carlson would love to spend his show on, is just like, look at this undocumented immigrant, they did this terrible thing. I mean, we saw a bunch of those stories during the Trump years, and it's hard to like remember even most of them for me. I'm sure you remember them, Dar, because like you were following this closely.
Yeah, but they were all recycled from like it is going to be very interesting to see what happens when there is an actual news hole, because the one story that, you know, really created its own news cycles was the killing of Kate Steinle, but that's it. That's one. And that's not enough to really create, you know, that's not enough to like do a show every night on. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops.
Well, that's just like to kind of what I'm saying. I'm like wondering if like Biden's strategy of like not talking about this issue is even like a remotely good idea, because it does seem like this issue. I mean, I've been looking at Breitbart's homepage regularly. They are still talking about immigration. Tucker Carlson is still bringing up immigration. Like, I think if they do want to just like say like, look, we tried on this issue and move on, I don't think that's actually going to make the issue go away. It's like a question of if you just try to ignore this issue, I think you just let the culture war people take over and start spinning it in a way that is going to bring it up again. Maybe not during COVID, maybe not during an economic downturn as much, but eventually, I mean, I think we are going to start seeing Trumpism without Trump come right back to this issue.
Let's take a break. Talk about a white paper.
Support for The Weeds comes from Hydro. So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought. While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time. This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com, code WEEDS, to save up to $400. Hydro.com, code WEEDS.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
So the paper this week is called The Effect of Police Layoffs on Crime, a Natural Experiment Involving New Jersey's Two Largest Cities. And it's from Eric Pisa and Vijay Shilar. I might be butchering those names. Sorry if I am. But basically what the paper did is back during the Great Recession in around 2008, 2009, a lot of police departments around the country were facing big budget constraints. They had to decide, are we going to make cuts? And in New Jersey, Newark and Jersey City, the two biggest cities in the state, took different paths. Newark actually did end up laying off a sizable amount of its police force. I think it added up to about 13%, whereas Jersey City ended up making a deal. So there were some pay cuts and some benefits cuts, but they actually kept their police force intact overall. And what this paper looked at is like, look, this is a natural experiment to really go into the debate about like defund the police, like police force size. What are the ultimate effects on crime here when you decrease a police force significantly over a pretty rapid period? And what the paper found is that in Newark, where they did cut police, crime was noticeably higher compared to Jersey City, especially violent crime. The effects for violent crime were about twice as high. And this kind of matches what we've seen in some of the other research. This paper does a good job like highlighting some of the past literature on this area. And like it points out that like this is kind of the effect you would expect when there are more cops. You do see less crime, but particularly less violent crime. And I mean, that's what we saw here. I think what really makes this paper interesting is that it is a bit of a natural experiment, since it's not like these two cities were choosing like to want to cut their police forces. So like it's not something that they actively wanted to do, but it's something that at least one of them was forced to do. And so, yeah, I think for in terms of like this debate about like whether more cops are effective for fighting more crime, this is definitely another bit of evidence that like, in fact, more cops do help reduce crime.
So, Herman, I am actually skeptical of the analysis in this paper in a way I rarely am. And I'm hoping that you can kind of explain to me why I'm misunderstanding this. Because if you look at the figure in this paper that compares crime rates in Newark before and after the point where they laid off a bunch of officers to crime rates in Jersey City before and after that point as kind of the natural experiment comparison, what you see is that both property and violent crime were trending downward in Jersey City before the point, and both of them continue to trend downward after, more consistently in the case of property crime in particular. But like it's a trend that, you know, unsurprisingly, layoffs happening in a different city does not change those trends. But in Newark, even before the layoff point, violent crime was not going down. Violent crime was like flat to rising. And so the fact that it continued to rise after the layoffs, which is not addressed in the text of the paper, is like, I'm not sure that I should credit the layoffs as being the difference-making factor here. Property crime is going down before the layoffs and then like rises and then goes down again. But I'm not sure that the takeaway here isn't that whatever Jersey City was doing in the late 2000s shouldn't have, you know, like that was good and whatever Newark was doing was bad, rather than that the layoffs themselves were like led to higher crime.
I think that there are two ways to explain that. One is crime data, as you know, is very noisy. So even if you like smooth it out in these kinds of charts, you will see like spikes that or trends that like appear to be going in one direction, but it might be a result of like how you're smoothing this out overall. So I think that's one thing. That said, I mean, I think the paper does acknowledge that to some extent, and the research does show that it's not just the size of a police force that matters here. And in fact, some of the interesting things here is that Newark, as a result of laying off such a sizable portion of its police force, actually stopped doing some like evidence-based hotspot policing style stuff. And more than whether it decreased or increased or changed the composition of its police force, size of its police force, that could explain the results we're seeing here. I think it would still speak to like how much the size of a police force matters, because like if you don't have extra cops around to like be able to do hotspot policing, you still might see higher crime trends. But it is just to say that it's true that this doesn't explain, like, I don't think the size of the police force explains the entire effect we're seeing here. But I mean, I think it's telling that the effect gets bigger as time goes on too. So like the split between Newark and Jersey City just keeps growing a little more and more as time goes on, according to this paper, after the layoffs. And so that to me suggests that like, look, this probably is having an effect, but you're right. I wouldn't say it's like the whole thing.
You know, there's another paper. Stephen Mello did a paper looking at this same time period, because the Stimulus Act from 2009 provided some funding to cities to sort of avert police layoffs. But it had one of these, Congress likes to help researchers by incorporating largely arbitrary numerical cutoffs and things. So you can look at cities just above and just below the threshold. You know, when he shows that the cities that got the extra money had lower crime in the intervening couple of years, actually doesn't look in detail at what the cities did with the money. I mean, the program is designed to make it so that you're supposed to avoid officer layoffs, but cities can sometimes do mischief here. But that was the sort of, the political context was different back then. And so there was an Obama-Biden administration initiative that was specifically focused on this question of police officer layoffs, which I think is fairly unlikely to recur, even though they are arguing about state and local financial aid in Congress, which would have that kind of impact there. You know, I've been interested that like a lot of people have published on this subject over the years. Oftentimes when things academics work on become relevant to the news, they get excited and eager to speak up. That has not been my experience with people who have published in the police staffing research space, particularly those who did it, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, back when, I mean, to an extent, like this finding used to be considered a liberal finding, right? It was Bill Clinton and Barack Obama had the two big federal like police hiring initiatives. And most of the research on this basically confirms that Democratic presidents did something good. The valence of it kind of switched around to the left is wrong about police. And certain people have like gone squirrely on their own findings in this wake. But, you know, when you think about a state and local, a purely local decision, right? I mean, the natural thing to follow up on here would be like, what's the other side of the trade-off, right? You got to lay off somebody, right? So there's like probably bad effects of whoever you lay off. And a case can be made that at the end of the day, you should lay off police officers. I do think some people over the past summer wanted to talk themselves into the idea that that was like a free lunch, right? In which like, you know, laying off librarians would be bad because people couldn't get books, but laying off police officers would have no negative consequences. But it's, you know, it's like any other public service. If you lay off the people, you don't get the output.
Well, I think another aspect here is that there is a cost to having more police officers as well, in the sense that there was another study, I can't remember for the life of me who published it, but there was another study that's like spoke to these issues, and it kind of looked at the breakdown on race on like the effect of having more police officers. And it found that, yes, having more police officers reduced homicide overall, but it also found that there were more arrests for like low level crimes, basically the kind of stuff that you would expect in like broken windows policing, like misdemeanor drug enforcement kind of stuff. You see more of that. And that is a cost. And I think it's notable that this paper does not look at that stuff, but I mean that as a cost in the sense of like, that's the kind of stuff that makes a lot of people in minority communities feel harassed every day when they're being stopped for stuff that probably shouldn't be crimes in their eyes. Like, should I really be getting stopped by a police officer for having loose cigarettes, or should somebody else be taking care of that problem? Like, that's I think what this paper is missing. And I think it's a noticeable aspect of it.
That was the paper that you wrote about in the Weeds newsletter last week, right? This is why people should subscribe to the Weeds newsletter.
Yes, that's right. If you want to subscribe, that's vox.com/weeds-newsletter. Anyway, but yes, that paper basically, like, it goes to show that like you have to balance this stuff out. Like, you can hire more police officers, you can make them more effective. But I think kind of the point that like Matt has been making more broadly is like, you still want to do the reform stuff to hold cops accountable. You still want to make sure they're going after the right crimes. And this paper speaks to it too. Like, there are still more better evidence-based strategies to be focusing, not on like whole neighborhoods or whole communities, but like certain segments that are more likely to be committing more crime, like the hotspot policing, the focused deterrence strategies. Those seem to be more effective, on top of perhaps just having more cops around to actually be able to do those things.
Can you explain hotspot policing? Because I find the findings on this to be wild.
Right. It's basically just that having cops around stops crime. Like, you're, I mean, if you just think about this, like, really practically, if you're walking down the street and you see a cop on the other side of the street, you're probably not as likely to try to kill someone in front of that cop, because you know you're going to get caught. And basically what this research does is like, the whole thinking is you saturate these like certain blocks where you know crime is unusually high relative to the rest of the city. You saturate those areas with a lot of cops. Like, you have lots of cops patrolling, you have lots of cops in sometimes just sitting in their police cars. And it seems to work. I think one of the big things here is it works by even just reducing the amount of arrests that cops actually can make in the end, because the presence of the cops is reducing crime. So there's fewer crimes to actually arrest people for. So that's one of the things that like makes this good if you want to stop like higher incarceration rates. It kind of speaks to the give and take here in terms of like hiring more cops versus more arrests. There actually might be a benefit to reducing mass incarceration by just hiring more cops and just saturating certain areas of a city with them.
Right. And then the question becomes like, if you hire a bunch of people, give them guns and legal justification to use deadly force if they feel threatened, and then tell them that their actual job is to stand around and not do things, is that going to work? And that's where we get into the kind of, you know, not just policing strategy, but like the relationship between strategy and the kind of organizational culture questions that you know, you were alluding to earlier, Herman, that Matt has addressed. The substance of what police are doing on a daily basis is really the fraught political thing, and something where research can only give us a certain amount of indication as to how to move forward.
Well, and I think from the public too, because I think when people see hotspot policing in action, it looks really stupid to them, because you literally talking about police officers standing still on a corner on the theory that a lot of crimes have happened on that block. And I remember around actually where Jane's old apartment, but before there was condos there, there used to be a lot of crime there. And at a certain point, the MPTC did a hotspot initiative. They brought one of these really bright lights that they have, and they just like had a squad car always be there. And I remember people on the listserv were like, this is so stupid, guys. Like, they can just do the crimes around the corner. Like, you've got to go do something. Like, people wanted to see the police officers doing something about the gang violence problem, not sitting in their car at some corner where there had been a crime last week. And I was like typing out. I was like, there's actually good research for this. Like, it's fine. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I was not able to conduct a, you know, regression discontinuity study on that block. But it is what the research says you should do, right? Is just send people to go to particular areas with high crime incidence and just kind of be there. And I think it's a very unintuitive way to invest resources, right? Both from the side of the officers, but also to the extent that the public wants to see, like, the mayor getting tough on crime. I mean, maybe they don't, right? Maybe they want to see the mayor, like, reforming the police department. But if people are upset about crime and they want to see you taking action, I think they want to see something that looks more like taking action, right? There's no guns on the table because you don't arrest anybody, right? The idea is that people will say, oh, this cop's there. I just won't do the crimes, which is good, right? Like, that's a good outcome for society, but it's not a great, it doesn't have like the political drama that you're looking for.
Right. And I mean, the flip side of it is if cops are doing this stuff and then they're pressured or feel pressure to actually go and do stuff, then they might start harassing people for stupid nonsense. So like, it kind of speaks to like that organizational structure that Dara was speaking to, like the what cops are expected to do, what we should expect cops to do, and like what they're being held accountable for. Because like, you could tell like these cops as you're deploying them, like, look, please do not make these low level arrests. But if you're a police department, you don't, maybe you feel like you've been too tough on your officers recently, like the unions telling you that you're making them feel like their time is being wasted, like, you might turn the other way, look the other way when they are actually doing hotspot policing, quote unquote, but in effect, just harassing a bunch of people in the neighborhood. So it's just, again, there's a balancing act here. And I don't think this study does enough to like show that, like, look, that just because this might have happened in Jersey City versus Newark, like, necessarily in every city, if you start doing hire more cops, even trying stuff like hotspot policing, that'll work out as you would want it to.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for another exciting episode of The Weeds. Thanks to Armand for coming on with us today. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors, our producer, Eric Janakis. And The Weeds will be back on Friday.